Good evening and welcome. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, hiring surges nationwide, but longer-term trends show an increasing number of working-age men are dropping out of the labor force altogether.
What U.S. officials call a Chinese surveillance balloon spotted flying over the central United States raises tensions in the already strained relationship between the two nations.
And Western states that rely on the drought-stricken Colorado River failed to reach an agreement on cutting water consumption. We take a look at what it means.
Welcome to the NewsHour. We're following two major stories tonight. Defense Department officials are tracking a suspected Chinese surveillance balloon that's making its way across the central part of the U.S.
And job growth surged last month, shaking off fears of a hiring slowdown. Let's delve first into the economic news. Employers added 517,000 jobs last month, a hiring boom far stronger than anyone had expected. The jobless rate dropped to 3.4%. That's the lowest level in 53 years. The latest jobs report also underscores the challenges facing Federal Reserve officials who are focused on slowing inflation. And as economics correspondent Paul Solomon tells us, it fuels more questions about a labor market that's proven more resilient for months now.
A big surprise.
Labor economist Julia Pollack on today's jobs report.
So many leading indicators turned sharply negative in the fourth quarter. Investment has been slow. Consumer spending has also been relatively sluggish. And yet, against that backdrop, job growth is exploding.
In fact, the latest jobs report found widespread hiring, particularly strong in hospitality, leisure, and healthcare. The latest revisions also found job growth was stronger than first reported in the past 2 months. But the pace of wage growth slowed in January, something the Federal Reserve wants to see more of before it stops raising interest rates.
This report is sort of the stuff of economics fiction. At a time of rapidly rising interest rates, to have both falling inflation and falling unemployment is almost unheard of. It's almost as though we're in the world with, you know, $20 bills on the sidewalk and free lunches.
President Biden didn't go quite that far this morning.
Good morning, everyone.
But he did take credit for a surge of hiring since he took office.
We have created more jobs in 2 years than any presidential term in 2 years. That's the strongest 2 years of job growth in history by a long shot.
And yet, employers still need more workers. A reported 2 job openings for every officially unemployed person in America. That's why the Fed may be concerned about the hiring boom announced this morning. The slowdown it wanted to see hasn't happened yet. But a major puzzle remains. The cost of living is up substantially, and yet the labor force participation rate is even lower than it was before the pandemic, which helps explain why there are millions of jobs unfilled. So why the shortfall?
The main reason is a huge decline in participation among older workers, and part of that may be driven by long COVID. We've seen an increase in the number of people reporting disabilities, especially cognitive disabilities.
Now, a bigger factor may be the workforce exit of healthy prime-age working men between the ages of 25 and 54. One familiar explanation, says Pollack.
The U.S. economy has experienced a hollowing out of the jobs in the middle, high-wage jobs with strong retirement benefits that used to be common among men without college degrees. Now, software has eaten many of those jobs, and so non-college-educated men have actually seen their working prospects fall.
I do have lots of friends who just stopped working. They're not even trying. They've fallen off the workforce.
54-year-old John Lilly, recently laid off and looking for work, has a few friends without degrees who've just given up. But how can they afford it?
I think they're just couch surfing on their parents' couches at 50 years old, waiting for people to die so they can inherit the house and that sort of thing. It's just a really bizarre situation right now.
And some of his peers simply balk at conforming to new workplace norms, he says.
Something like the pronouns, the gender pronouns, seems stupid to a middle-aged person. But it's not stupid if you want to get a job. If you want to get along with the work culture, you have to keep up with culture in general.
But a hollowed out labor market as the main cause of the male worker shortfall seems a stretch to economist Nicholas Eberstadt, who published Men Without Work in 2016, now in a post-pandemic edition.
The received wisdom is that economic and structural change is driving the decline in workforce participation for men. Outsourcing, decline of manufacturing, less demand for less skilled work, all of that's fine as far as it goes, but it's really only part of the story, and I don't think it's even most of the story.
And most of the story is?
Disability payments, dropouts, unintended consequences of our social welfare guarantees, and the invisible ex-con population, which is now maybe 25 million people in the United States.
And when you say ex-con, you mean they are formerly convicted, not necessarily formerly incarcerated.
Only one in 10 persons who has a felony conviction in their background is currently serving in prison. It's an order of magnitude bigger than our incarceration situation in the United States.
It's been almost impossible to get a job that pays a living wage.
Mike Tyner is one such American, though he did serve time on a bank robbery conviction. A college grad with a 3.7 GPA, even some grad school, he's had six actual job offers, all rescinded because of his felony conviction.
I get if you don't want me working in a bank if I robbed a bank. I get you don't want me working around money if I have had an issue with money in the past, but I can't clean a bus.
Okay, felony convictions, a hollowing out economy, government benefits, long COVID, a long list. But even that's not all.
Childcare is very expensive and hard to acquire right now.
33-year-old new stay-at-home dad Tom McFarland offers yet another reason.
Financially, it turned out to where childcare was basically going to take up our whole paycheck. So I chose to become a stay-at-home parent.
His wife, a veterinarian, supports the family on her salary. No surprise, as women keep outpacing men in college degrees and thus in earning potential.
In our case, it made financial sense and good professional sense.
Has he noticed more men his age becoming house husbands?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it made me feel more comfortable making the decision.
And how does he respond when asked why he's not working?
I'm currently working. I'm just working as a parent at home. I'm very proud to become to be a stay-at-home parent. I'm very proud to be a father.
So the moral of this story seems pretty clear. Prime-age men have dropped out for lots of reasons, contributing mightily to the curious case of a high cost of living economy with not enough workers to go around. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
Turning now to our other lead story tonight, Secretary Blinken decided to postpone a high-profile trip to Beijing this weekend in response to what the U.S. calls a Chinese spy balloon currently floating eastward across the country. Nick Schifrin has that story.
It's about 5:30 on Wednesday, February 1st, 2023.
It was first spotted over Montana.
I have no idea what this thing is. I hope it's in focus.
This morning, spotted 1,000 miles to the southeast above St. Joseph, Missouri. The U.S. calls it a spy balloon. Beijing today called it a civilian airship used for research, mainly meteorological purposes, that deviated far from its planned course. The Chinese side regrets the unintended entry of the airship into U.S. airspace due to force majeure, or uncontrolled forces. But senior U.S. officials say it's maneuverable, designed for surveillance, and Beijing was, quote, trying to fly this balloon over sensitive sites. Montana is home to one of the U.S.'s three intercontinental ballistic missile silos. Yesterday, the U.S. mobilized F-22 jets. Their administration officials says President Biden took his military advisor's advice and decided not to shoot the balloon down because of the risk to people on the ground.
We do recognize that any potential debris field would be significant and potentially cause civilian injuries or deaths or significant property damage.
Today, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken canceled what would have been the most senior trip of the Biden administration to China.
What this has done is created the conditions that undermine the purpose of the trip, including ongoing efforts to build a floor under the relationship and to address a broad range of issues that are of concern to the American people, I believe to the Chinese people, and certainly as well to people around the world.
U.S. officials say China has sent spy balloons over the U.S. before, but never for this extended period of time, and never right before a Secretary of State visit.
The most important thing right now in the moment is to see that this surveillance asset gets out of our airspace.
But House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Representative Mike McCaul said the administration should have shot it down earlier. This balloon should have never been allowed to enter U.S. airspace. It now poses a direct and ongoing national security threat to the U.S. homeland.
It's certainly not a standard weather balloon. That's a given.
Paul Fetkowitz owns Caymont Consolidated Industries, the largest American provider of meteorological balloons to the U.S. government, including the military.
We can see on it that there's a solar arrays to have a battery power, you know, to supply power to maybe a camera, maybe a heat source. The fact that they don't want us to gently bring the balloon down in our territory and have us go grab it for them is, it's kind of saying something to me that they don't want anybody to get their hands on this balloon.
We got this weird thing above this thing is weird.
The current trajectory shows the balloon will float toward the Atlantic Ocean. U.S. officials won't reveal their plans other than to say they're monitoring. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
It is not the moon.
In the day's other headlines, some of the coldest weather in decades descended on the Northeast and New England. Those venturing outside faced wind chills that could reach 50 below this weekend. Many communities opened warming centers and closed schools today. Elsewhere, the weather began to warm in Texas after an ice storm this week, but power was still out to more than 100,000 customers around Austin. Utilities said they could not estimate how long repairs will take. The U.S. has announced another big military package for Ukraine, worth more than $2 billion and including longer-range rockets. They can fly nearly twice as far as the rockets provided so far. Meantime, in Kyiv today, European Union leaders pledged their continued support. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the war has reached a pivotal point.
We are preparing. We believe, intelligence and military, that Russia will increase pressure in the country's east. Russia wants revenge in the area where they did not succeed. Our task is to prevent this from happening, and I believe we have a chance.
Zelensky vowed his forces will resist Russia's ongoing assault on Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine for as long as possible. Pope Francis arrived in South Sudan today, urging the country's leaders to make peace after years of war. He was welcomed by the president and thousands of well-wishers. Later, he warned that history will judge those who worked to end the fighting and those who did not. The Pope was joined by Anglican and Scottish Presbyterian leaders, along with Catholics. Their followers make up most of South Sudan's population. Back in this country, the U.S. Agriculture Department is calling for school cafeterias to cut back on added sugar and sodium. The agency today proposed new standards, including the first ever limits on sugar in yogurt, cereal, and other foods. Those rules would take effect by the fall of 2027. Cuts in sodium levels would take effect 2 years later. Police in Dallas have arrested a man in a series of strange events at the city zoo. He's charged with animal cruelty and the taking of two emperor tamarin monkeys this week. The monkeys disappeared Monday from their enclosure. Police found them the next day at a vacant house. Zoo officials said today the tamarins are recovering.
We're treating their return to the zoo as if they were coming from an unknown source. So they're in a medical quarantine right now to make sure that they settle back in, that they regain some weight, and that the stress of their theft and removal from known habitat doesn't have longer lasting effects on them.
The same suspect is also charged with burglary for allegedly letting a small leopard escape and trying to cut open another monkey enclosure. The leopard was found later still inside the zoo. A fourth incident, the death of a vulture, remains under investigation. There's no word on a motive. And on Wall Street, the January jobs data revived fears that the Federal Reserve will push bigger interest rate hikes to slow the economy and dampen inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 128 points to close at 33,926. The NASDAQ fell nearly 194 points, or 1.5%. And the S&P 500 was down 1%. Still to come on the NewsHour, abortion providers resort to mobile centers to meet women's health care needs. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines. And a global music festival helps international musicians reach larger audiences.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Beyond today's headlines about an apparent surveillance balloon and Secretary Blinken's canceled trip to Beijing lie the much broader relationship between the world's two largest economies. The U.S. and China are competing for influence on many fronts across the world. Here again is Nick Schifrin.
To better focus the U.S. government's efforts to confront China, the new Congress created a new panel to examine the relationship, the Select Committee on the Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party. With me now are the new committee's two leaders, Republican Chairman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin and Democratic Ranking Member Raja Krishnamoorthy of Illinois for their first joint interview. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Welcome to the NewsHour. Chairman Gallagher, let me start with you on the news of the day. Defense officials told congressional staffers today that the balloon entered continental U.S. airspace on January 31st. Do you believe they could have and should have shot this balloon down safely at that point?
Yes, I do, particularly if we were tracking it as it transited over the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. I don't think there's any serious concern about debris in that area. Furthermore, I don't know why we didn't have the same ability to shoot it down over sparsely populated areas over Canada in partnership with our allies in Canada, or even Montana. And if the Pentagon is telling us that they don't have this capability, well, then that's a capability we absolutely need to develop going forward, and we need to be using our defense budget in order to develop that capability.
Ranking Member, Chairman Milley today told congressional officials that DOD needed a 20-mile by 20-mile box to safely bring this down, and it wasn't safe to bring it down for fear of some kind of civilian casualties on the ground. Do you agree with that?
I think we should defer to the military leaders like Chairman Milley, as well as the head of the Northern Command. I think they also pointed out that this particular balloon is no longer collecting intelligence, perhaps because of countermeasures. And then at the end of the day, there's the risk, obviously, of the debris field injuring somebody or causing property damage. But we also, in my opinion, want to preserve the tech. In a lot of cases, both Mike and I are members of the Intelligence Committee as well. We want to be able to know exactly what the technological capabilities are of the Chinese Communist Party. So preserving that technology and being able to learn more about it is invaluable as well.
Ranking Member, sorry, let me just make sure I understand. You believe that they could have brought the balloon down safely and preserved the tech?
If they can do that, I think they'll probably do everything they can to make that happen. Perhaps it will lose altitude in a sparsely populated area of the country, and they'll be able to recover it. And then we can examine it, and then I'm sure the Chinese will want it back, and we'll say we'll return it upon determining that it's proper for weather purposes at the appropriate time.
Chairman Gallagher, U.S. officials tell me that they were concerned about sending Secretary Blinken to Beijing while the balloon was over U.S. airspace. Do you believe they made the right decision in postponing his trip?
I do. I called for it this morning, and I think he should just cancel the trip as opposed to a postponement, but maybe that's semantics. I think the next time we meet, the Chinese officials should come to America, and I think we deserve an apology for this violation of U.S. sovereignty. I think this tells us something fundamental about the regime we're dealing with here. And just remember the way in which Chinese diplomats acted in the first meeting that they had with Secretary Blinken in Alaska, berating them, you know, talking about the horrible human rights record in America. Remember what they did to Wendy Sherman. So it's definitely in their playbook to do something like this in order to embarrass our diplomats. And the optics of a grip and grin with Xi Jinping, I think, just would have looked bizarre so soon after this incident. So they made the right call. And I think it kind of gets to the core mission that we have on the Select Committee on China. We believe our foreign policy is stronger when Republicans and Democrats are working together. It's why I'm so thrilled and couldn't be more excited to work with Raj. We have a long history of working together on foreign policy issues. I have a profound respect for his intellect. I know we have a shared understanding of the ideological, economic, and military threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party. So we're really excited to work together on the preeminent foreign policy challenge of our lifetime.
Ranking Member Krishnamurthy, the administration says it wants to keep dialogue open with Beijing. So why not send Secretary Blinken to read them the Riot Act, sure, during every meeting, but also discuss so many of the issues that your committee also is going to be discussing publicly?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Mike for those kind words. I echo his sentiments about working with him, even though he is a Green Bay Packers fan. But setting that aside for a moment, I have to say that with regard to Secretary Blinken going to China or the People's Republic of China, that would be a bad move. Because, you know, what they did was they violated American airspace and our sovereignty. And that, you know, basically undermines their diplomatic overtures and it calls into question the sincerity of those overtures. So I think it's appropriate for Secretary Blinken to postpone the trip. I'm sure that they're communicating in other ways right now. And I hope that they make it very clear that this is completely unacceptable going forward, especially if we want to, as Secretary Blinken said, set a floor for our relationship, because it hasn't been, improving the way it should be over the past couple of years.
Let me ask you both about Taiwan. Yesterday, CIA Director Bill Burns said that as a matter of intelligence, the U.S. believes Xi Jinping ordered his military to be prepared, not necessarily a decision, but prepared to invade Taiwan by 2027. Chairman Gallagher, do you think the U.S. is willing to go to war over Taiwan? The American people are prepared to suffer the massive casualties that the military believes might happen if that war actually gets instigated?
Well, I'm concerned that we are doing things counterproductive to the defense of Taiwan, such as trying to cut the size of the U.S. Navy. The Biden administration's plan, defense plan that they submitted last year, would have had the Navy bottom out in 2027 at the worst possible point. We're talking about our priority force in the priority theater. So I've been concerned at the lack of urgency. I believe we've entered the window of maximum danger. We've obviously had a memo recently by an Air Force general saying that things could get frisky in 2025. I'm worried about 2024, particularly after the Taiwanese elections in January of 2024. So we need to be moving heaven and earth to restore our deterrent posture in the Indo-Pacific. That being said, I salute the administration's recent announcement of enhanced basing agreements with both Japan and the Philippines. That's a massive step forward. What we're seeing the Japanese do on their own, increasing their defense spending, is a massive help to our efforts. So those are good things. We just need to be moving with a greater sense of urgency.
Ranking Member Krishnamurthy, obviously we hear a lot about the military not moving fast enough, despite some of the moves that Chairman Gallagher just mentioned. But I also talked to some experts who fear the opposite, who say that alongside the steps that the U.S. is taking in the Pacific, alongside the assurance given to allies, there needs to be more reassurance to Beijing, and that without that reassurance, Beijing could feel backed into a corner, leading to the very war that the U.S. is trying to deter. What do you say to those voices?
I think that we should provide, clear messages about red lines, and I think that the Biden administration has been communicating those, just as President Biden did recently with Chairman Xi. But at the end of the day, the Chinese Communist Party is throwing its elbows in its neighborhood, whether it's in the South China Sea, whether it's with regard to Taiwan, or whether it's with regard to others who desperately seek an international rules-based order in that region of the world. And that's why we have to work with our partners, friends, and allies in the region to help supply their defensive needs and work with them for our collective mutual defense to deter aggression. At the end of the day, we do not want a cold war. We don't want a hot war. We don't want open hostilities. But the only way to do that is to prepare our mutual defense to discourage and deter aggression, and then hopefully work with Beijing on common long-term challenges, whether it's fighting climate change or even bringing an end to the war in Ukraine. But right now, with this balloon situation, it obviously exposes that the threat is real from the Chinese Communist Party.
Ranking Member Krishnamurthy, Chairman Gallagher of the new House Select Committee on China, thank you very much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was a major week in the battle out west over water use. Seven states along the Colorado River Basin were supposed to have reached a collective agreement on how to use less water from an ever-shrinking river, but they failed to do so. Six states reached a modest agreement, but it would have required major cuts in water use by California, which is the largest user. California, for its part, submitted its own proposal. But that stalemate may force the federal government to make difficult cuts instead. William Brangham has more for our occasional series on water issues called Tipping Point.
Jeff, the central issue here is that the amount of water flowing down the Colorado River is shrinking, while the demand for that water by those states is growing. A mega drought compounded by climate change is directly at odds with the thirsty cities and farms of the American West. The water of the Colorado River is collected in the country's two biggest reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, and those lakes are now three-quarters empty. The Biden administration asked those seven states to cut their collective withdrawal from the Colorado by about a third, but we are a long way from getting there. For more on all of this, I'm joined by Rhett Larson. He's a water rights professor at Arizona State University. Rhett Larson, so good to have you on the NewsHour. Could you just elaborate a little bit? I laid out what seems to be the essential issue here. What would you add to that?
Well, what we're going through right now is a little bit like a bankruptcy proceeding. It's like the river declaring bankruptcy. From the very beginning of the way that the states had shared the Colorado River, we had made assumptions about how much the river could pay out in any given year. Those assumptions that were made now a century ago were wrong, and we're paying the price for those incorrect assumptions. Now, those assumptions were wrong both because the data was bad 100 years ago. It's also wrong because the population has obviously changed a lot. And it's wrong because the climate has changed quite a bit. So even though we're getting around 90% of our normal snowpack and precipitation, our winters are so short and they're so hot that a lot of that water just isn't reaching the river. So this combination of factors has caused what is something like a bankruptcy proceeding, where you have lots of people who have a claim to a common resource, and the resource just can't pay out to everyone who has a claim to it.
So those seven states were supposed to come up with a plan. Six of them did come up with a plan, not including California. The six states that did submit a plan relied a lot on the issue of evaporation in their argument. Can you succinctly explain what they were arguing?
Sure. So you mentioned having too many straws in the river, too many users. Well, there's a user that we've never really accounted for, and that user is the atmosphere. The atmosphere takes away about 1.5 million acre feet away from the lower basin of the Colorado River every year. But we don't treat that as if it's a use that's being taken out of the river. So part of the proposal of those six basin states is, let's just treat that 1.5 million acre feet like it's a user taking that amount of water out, and we'll just spread those cuts out amongst everyone who is using the river. Now, the way to spread those cuts out is complicated, but probably best that the people who have to move the water the farthest are the people who have to take the biggest cuts, because they're moving it through canals that are open to the air and they're losing the most water to evaporation.
So what is California arguing in this? It's the biggest user by far, principally California agriculture, and it's the longest owner of those rights. What are they arguing?
Well, we've been through a series of negotiations in the last several years about how to share in shortage. But for decades, California has had what is senior priority. So in the Western United States, we operate under a prior appropriation regime, the first in time, the first in right. California, for a host of reasons, sits at or near the front of the line when it comes to those water uses. So California's argument is, we have senior priority. We are the first user with legal rights, so we shouldn't have to take cuts first.
Amidst all of this haggling in a shrinking river, and there's this issue of what's called deadpool. Can you explain what deadpool is and what would happen if we hit that point?
Deadpool is the point at which the reservoir levels have sunk so low that we can't take water out of the reservoir anymore. So effectively, we're no longer regulating the river with a dam. It just becomes a run of the river, meaning the river's just flowing and there's no storage. when you talk about California's power, its political power, its economic power, its legal power, you might ask, why would they ever make a compromise? Why would they ever compromise? Part of that is the risk of Deadpool is so real and its risk is so imminent within the next couple of years. And Deadpool would affect all of us, that it is in everyone's best interest, all the basin states, to come up with a solution, because Deadpool is a legitimate risk within the next couple of years if we don't act soon.
All right, Rhett Larson at Arizona State University, thank you so much.
My pleasure, thank you.
In some parts of the country, access to abortion care depends on how far a person can travel. Missouri has banned the procedure, but in neighboring Illinois, abortion remains legal, and providers there will soon be working along the state border to be able to reach more patients. PBS NewsHour Communities correspondent Gabrielle Hayes joins us with more on the abortion landscape in the Midwest. Gabby, it's good to see you. So abortion outlawed in Missouri for more than 6 months now. No exceptions for rape or incest, limited exceptions for medical emergencies, we should say. In that time, as you've been reporting, what have you seen in terms of both how many people are actually seeking abortion access and how providers are meeting that need?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the first thing is, you know, 100 days after Roe fell, providers, Planned Parenthood made the announcement that they would be launching a mobile clinic at the Southern Illinois border. And I should say that's the first time that they've ever done anything like that. Providers there tell me that that is in response not only to a stark rise in people looking for care, but also it serves as a symbol of their act of defiance in a post-Roe era, is what I was told. And so that mobile clinic, I'm told, is set to launch in the coming months, and that it will start with medication abortions before transitioning into procedural abortions. But I think, again, you know, we're talking about a state ban where people are traveling from all over the state, so across our western border. We also know that Kansas now has telemedicine abortions, and providers there tell me, you know, when they look at their parking lot, they're seeing license plates from all over the country because people are coming there to utilize their resources. But it's also important to know that those things come with stipulations, right? So you have to be in Kansas in order to utilize the telemedicine abortions. And so I think although it's not legal in the state of Missouri, the states around us are trying to figure out a way to provide those resources to people who are looking for care.
Gabby, but in Missouri, we're talking about abortion being outlawed, right? But in the state of Missouri, what about access to other kinds of reproductive care? What does that look like right now?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good question, because the one thing that providers have stressed to me is that, you know, we're not only looking at a heightened sense of trying to figure out where people can find access to abortion, but access to health care, period. And there's an emphasis on, you know, rural areas. In the state of Missouri, according to the state's own data, we're looking at 33% of, you know, people in our state living in a rural county. That's more than 2 million people, right? And so 2 million people looking for access to all kinds of care. And so Planned Parenthood recently took over a clinic in Rolla, Missouri, and that's where they're hoping to provide access to other types of reproductive care to people who live in rural Missouri. And I'm told that they're hoping and moving forward to be able to expand to vasectomies and other types of care in that area.
So Gabby, in about the minute or so we have left, we know that abortion ban in Missouri is being challenged. Where do those challenges stand right now?
Absolutely. Well, just days before the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, we had 13 clergy members from six different faith backgrounds who filed a lawsuit here in Missouri challenging the abortion ban. And what they're arguing is that it is unconstitutional because it takes one religious doctrine and imposes it on everybody else. And so we will be following that lawsuit closely. But that is the latest challenge here in Missouri.
That is our PBS NewsHour Communities correspondent, Gabrielle Hayes, reporting for us. Gabby, thank you so much. And you can read more of Gabby's reporting on abortion access online at pbs.org/newshour.
Democrats map a new path to the White House. The previous president's third run gets off to a sluggish start, and a balloon raises tensions between world superpowers. For analysis of the week's news, Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. It's great to see you both.
Hey, Jeff.
And let's start with the race for the White House. Donald Trump's third presidential campaign appears to be off to a slow start. His fundraising haul is less than what he certainly expected. His support among a key part of his base, white evangelicals, has splintered. Still, he's a known quantity. His base of support is larger than his prospective GOP rivals. What's your assessment of his standing right now?
I think right now he's sinking. The polls are all over the place, but the higher quality polls show significant slippage. If you look at how many times he's mentioned on places like Fox News, it's plummeting. If you listen to talk radio, friends of mine who listen more to conservative talk radio than I do, say there's hostility. When he said he wouldn't necessarily endorse the Republican candidate, there was bitterness and hostility toward Trump, which you don't often see in that quarter. He's running a much more conventional campaign. You know, in 2016, he was sort of the witty outsider. Now he's running a normal campaign where he's trying to woo the Republican establishment. His opponents are a lot better informed about what their party really wants. Mm. So I think all in all, he could be saved by the fact that Republicans have winner-take-all primaries to quite a high degree. And so if he gets 28%, he could get 100% of the delegates in some states. Mm. But overall, I think there's a lot of evidence to show serious slippage.
Jonathan, Nikki Haley is expected to announce her bid, her presidential run, on February 15th. Former Vice President Mike Pence is said to be in prayerful consideration of a potential 2024 bid. How do potential Trump challengers thread this needle of building a coalition without alienating Trump supporters?
That's a great question for David. I mean, that means getting into their heads. That I don't know. We're about to find out. Nikki Haley is going to be the canary in the coal mine. Mike Pence could be the next one. Ron DeSantis assuredly will be the next one. To add on to something David was talking about, the Republican electorate is better informed, but I think these people who are considering jumping into the race against Donald Trump are better informed about who he is, how he reacts. The only thing we don't know is how will they react when they get punched in the face rhetorically by Donald Trump. How do they react when the big negative stories come out, if they come out, about them, and then he attacks them? How do they respond? I think right now, they have more to fear about their own abilities to run the race than they do about anything Donald Trump will do to them as an opponent.
And David, Republicans who say they want to turn the page away from the Trump era note that the GOP needs to keep the field from being too crowded. That's what happened in 2016 that led to the emergence of Donald Trump, the nominee. Might that happen again?
I think less than in 2016. If you go back and look at the polls where we were this time in 2016, there were a lot of people with 9 or 10 points, like Christie, Rubio, Ted Cruz. Now, right now, there's Trump and DeSantis, and everybody else is like 2. And so right now, it's those 2. And if it gets down to Trump and 3 others, I think the pressure on 2 of those 3 others to drop out will be enormous. The thing that I'm curious about with the Republican field is, will the electorate split into 2 wings? Will there be a Trump wing, which could include both Trump and DeSantis, and then a regular Republican wing, which could include people like Larry Hogan, the former governor of Maryland, and Glenn Youngkin, the governor of Virginia? And so it could be that Trump and DeSantis are fighting over some of the same voters. I'm not sure the party will split that neatly, but it could.
Well, let's talk about Ron DeSantis, because the Florida Republican governor, widely expected to run for president. The College Board this past week, they changed the course offering for their AP African American Studies course following criticism from Ron DeSantis and other Republicans. We spoke to the CEO of the College Board on this program this past week, and he said that the changes that were made to the course had nothing to do with the public discussion, with the criticism that the College Board faced. Take a look.
The revisions were complete by the end of December, far before this public discussion. And what the revisions were based only on 2 sources, the feedback from professors and students and teachers in the pilot course, and returning to principles that are true of every single AP course.
Do you buy what the College Board is saying?
I do. We're talking about academics. not politicians. I mean, these sorts of things happen in academia all the time. Just because you write a book, just because you teach a course, just because you've written an important article that was big in the social discussion, doesn't automatically mean that it needs to be taught in a classroom. And I know I'm going to get in trouble with a lot of people, but I want to pull the camera, the aperture back here. What Ron DeSantis is doing is deeply, deeply insulting. What he's basically saying to the nation and to African Americans in particular, it's that your role in the building of this country, the maintenance of this country, means nothing. That without you, we could have gotten along just fine. And that's what's so, it's insulting, it's hurtful. And think about this, Jeff. The fact that you and I are sitting here right now, you in an anchor chair, me as a guest, on television, could that have happened 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 1619? No, it couldn't. It couldn't have. And one thing I like to remind people, particularly young people, history is not really history when you're talking about African Americans in this country. My cousins and I are the first generation in my family to not have to pick cotton. We are the first generation that did not have to live under Jim Crow. I'm 55 years old. That's how long this has been a democracy. So Governor DeSantis, if you want Americans to truly understand how great this country is, you cannot understand how great this country is without filling in those gaps and holes with the history of African Americans in this country.
David?
Yeah, I've known David Coleman a bit over the last several years who you interviewed. He's always struck me as a remarkably upstanding guy, a guy who's very fair, meticulously wants everybody to feel represented in this test. So I take him at his word, and I think they have documents, dated documents, showing they made the changes. I would have told him after the DeSantis thing, like, wait a month, like, show some political ear, because there are people, David Blight, who wrote a magisterial biography of Frederick Douglass, he said, wait, what's going on? So there's questions people have. But I take them at their word that, you know, the big change was they realized high school students don't like theory, they like primary documents. Well, I could have told them that. I know high school students. So I think that on the one hand, and then I agree with Jonathan on DeSantis, that at any time in American history, one needs to be forward-leaning about African-American history. That's been true and should have been true since 1619. It certainly should have been true today. I mean, I'd ask Ron DeSantis to go to the African American History Museum. It's a very fair portrayal of American history and a very moving. They have Clarence Thomas is in their museum, Susan Rice is in the museum, Condoleezza Rice. And so they span the diversity of black history. And so you can do that. And I trust that when at the end of the day, this curriculum will end up doing that.
Well, in the time that remains, let's talk about what Democrats are going to be doing this weekend. They're going to vote on this new primary calendar proposed by President Biden that would do a number of things. It would remove Iowa from its primary position. It would push South Carolina forward in the calendar, followed by New Hampshire and Nevada 1 week later, and then primaries in Georgia and Michigan. Jonathan, what's your assessment of this new strategy here?
Those states are more representative of our country than Iowa going first, New Hampshire going next. The Democrats tried to rectify the situation by adding Nevada and then South Carolina. But look, this country is changing quickly. And if we're going to have if we're going to have an electorate that looks like the country voting for the president, we've got to change the system. And I think that the way that works, those states are great. My only question is, 1 week after the other, that's the thing that gives me a little pause, not the states.
What about that? I mean, we expect President Biden to make his intentions known after the State of the Union address. He said to not want to deliver that address as a candidate. He wants to deliver it as a president. But if he's the only Democrat running, what difference does this calendar make?
Well, maybe not much short term. I'm pretty sure he's going to run. I'm pretty sure he's going to be the nominee. So, but long term, you know, when I look at a calendar, I want three things. One, I wanted for early states to be diverse. There's a period, I think Biden used to make this point, where a lot of candidates had dropped out of the race by the time 98% or 99% of black and Latino voters could vote. And so that seems wrong. Second, I want it to be a small state. because I don't want a big state. It just takes so much money to run. I fear if you're not an insider candidate with tons of fundraising, you can't compete in Pennsylvania, Michigan. So you want to, South Carolina's reasonably small. And third, and most important, I want the state to be biased in the way I like Democratic candidates. And so South Carolina is an older state. It's a military state. And so it tends to select the more moderate. So if I'm Bernie Sanders, I'm probably not happy or that kind of candidate. Right. But but a moderate Democrat, it'll probably tend to favor them.
David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, thanks as always for your insights.
Thanks, Jeff.
The sounds of the world brought to New York for one night. And from there, perhaps to a club or concert hall or festival near you. Jeffrey Brown reports on the phenomenon called Global Fest for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
You've likely heard the marimba before, but not played quite like this. This is the Mexican band Son Rompe Pera, who've created a distinctive blend of, as the t-shirt says, cumbia, the traditional Latin American music, and punk. And here they were recently in what is for them a very unusual setting, New York's Lincoln Center. Jesus Gama is one of three brothers in the band.
To come here and play and be seen by different people from all over the world, that's something unique. For a street band to arrive in these places is something very, very good, especially in Mexico, where it's difficult to get support.
International musicians being seen and supported to tour in the U.S. It's what the annual Global Fest gathering is about. The audience is a mix of the general public and, crucially, more than 1,000 representatives from performing arts centers around the country, eager to learn about new acts and, if the stars align, bring them to their audiences back home.
It's a unique place because you have an audience that's mixed with arts professionals and the general public, and you don't know who's who. So you don't know who you're sitting next to, but they might be booking a major festival or concert hall anywhere across the country or around the world.
I saw Marchita here.
Oh, how was it?
Isabel Sofer co-founded Global Fest 20 years ago with Bill Bragan and Shanta Thake, who's also chief artistic officer here at Lincoln Center, which has now given Global Fest a new home for the festival. It began, says Sofer, after 9/11, amid fears of isolationism, a way to ensure more Americans are exposed to global culture.
We know that music plays a key role in people's understanding of the world, and we take that really seriously. And we do want to challenge both audiences and presenters, and to just think more critically about where these people are from.
This year, chosen from among hundreds of submissions, they came from countries including Morocco. The ecstatic singing and playing of the all-women group, Benat El Huariat, joined by Algerian-American dancer Esra Warda. And Spain, singer Maria Jose Yergo. And they represented varying styles of music, like that of the New York Arabic Orchestra. The event spreads across three stages with overlapping performances, allowing the audience to move around, hear all 10 acts, and for professional arts presenters to do some serious business. Jamila Derrier is director of the Fine Arts Center at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst.
It's critical as a presenter who isn't in a major market. I think that to be able to fly to Marrakesh and then France and Mexico City is a bit outside of my budget range.
Yeah,
and
so, much as you might want.
Yeah,
to.
As much as I. But yeah. The ability to just, you know, fill up the gas tank and drive down to New York for a few days to be able to see these artists in person, not only experience their music but the impact of their music on a Western audience. is invaluable.
We started with one artist.
Global Fest is actually a satellite festival held at the same time as a much larger annual convention, the Association of Performing Arts Professionals, or APAP. Here, Daria and thousands of others survey the current music, theater, and dance worlds and meet performers, agents, and managers to set up performances and tours. It's part of the country's performing arts ecosystem.
These are the two that are likely to...
They also meet other presenters who can band together in the case of bringing global acts to this country to defray the often large costs of travel, visas, and other touring expenses.
So you can go talk to the presenter in East Tennessee or the presenter in Maine, and they could be like standing alongside you and say, hey, do you love this guy? I love this guy. Let's do this. Let's bring them to our region.
And that makes it work economically.
You know, the cost of bringing a group from across the world is not for the faint of heart.
There's always at least one act at Global Fest that doesn't have to travel so far. An American musician or group the festival curators believe is ready for a bigger audience. This year it was the legendary Ingramettes, wonderfully named, powerfully voiced. Started by Maggie Ingram, now led by her daughter Almeda Ingram Miller and based in Richmond, Virginia, this is a group that's been singing in one form or another for some six decades, suddenly getting a new kind of attention.
We didn't really realize how many people have been watching what we do. We're still homegrown folks. We're still, you know, Richmond's first family of gospel.
True to their gospel roots, Miller says, the Ingramettes are about service, typically singing in churches, community centers, or schools. This, she knew, was going to be different.
There's going to be hundreds or a few thousand presenters from around the country.
Oh, my goodness.
You know that, right?
I do know.
Does that make you a little nervous?
You know what? Yeah. We're just going to come to have a good time and to share who we are and to share the music that we bring.
If you don't mind tonight, I'd just like to sing.
On stage a short time later, the legendary Ingramettes were sharing away to a happy crowd. And possibly, if Global Fest magic holds, they'll be sharing on a stage near you one day soon. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at Lincoln Center in New York.
I have a dream. Let justice run.
And there is much more online, including our interviews with several of the musicians up for Grammy Awards this Sunday. And be sure to join Yamiche Alcindor and her panel later tonight on Washington Week for more on this week's meeting between President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and on police reform efforts.
And watch PBS News Weekend with John Yang tomorrow for a look at the political and humanitarian crisis in Haiti. That is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Have a great weekend.